I am thrilled to do this show today. It's brought to you by the Harris family, and I so appreciate their sponsorship of this show. And it is, it's important that we understand our history. There is such an interest by people on their individual ancestry, but yet we've seen this canceling of our American history, and it's rich. These were human beings that were not perfect, but what happened with the American founding is astounding. And today, Ben Martin is on the line with me, and we're going to talk about some of these major battles. Ben Martin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Kim. I'm so glad to be here. Good morning to you. How's everyone going with you?
It is just going, I'm so excited to do this show, so it's going great. And I actually took a class that you had put together a number of years ago about America's founding heritage, and you brought these men and women and their stories alive. So let's jump in here. Where should we start?
Well, okay. Well, let's hope we can do that a little bit for your listeners out there. So today we're going to talk about the first battles of the Revolutionary War, and those were the ones that were around the Boston area, and they were called Lexington and Concord. As many people, many Americans, in fact, know of the battle. They've heard of the thing called the shot heard round the world,
mm-hmm.
and they've even heard of the short battle at Lexington. But fewer know that the fighting that day included Concord, the battle there, and the 20 miles of fighting back to Boston. And many cannot say which side even won the battle that day, or the battles that day. So today, we're going to talk about that whole battle and the struggle to get back to Boston. And hopefully, it'll make some people more aware of our rich, as you talked about before, our rich American founding heritage. And although, like you said, those people that did this weren't perfect, they were pretty darn good. Let's get on with it. In our last presentation, we discussed the French and Indian War, you remember, and its mm-hmm. tremendous cost to Britain, and that was the precursor to the American Revolutionary War. And at the end of that war, in the signing of the 1763 Treaty of Paris, not to be confused with the Treaty of Paris that ended the Revolutionary War, there was a British officer who had been with Washington during that overwhelming British defeat at the Battle of Monongahela that we mentioned a little bit last week, or at our last presentation. And he had been named the commander-in-chief of all the British forces in North America. And that's a pretty powerful position. In fact, it was the most powerful position that the British had in North America. And his name was General Thomas Gage. General Gage was a good administrator, we have to say that. But he wasn't so good as a soldier or a commander of soldiers. And in 1763 to 64, he spent most of his time as sink here in the North American continent, securing the colonists from Indian attacks. But because of the things we talked about last program, the 1764 Sugar Act and the 1765 Stamp Act, to name two, political tensions within the American colonists began to rise. And Gates began moving his troops from the frontiers of America back to the cities of New York and Boston. As a number of these soldiers began to increase in the cities, there was a greater need for housing and feeding them, Kim. So next came the Quartering Act of 1765, which raised the level of tensions even more.
Explain to our listeners what that was exactly, and the Quartering Act. What happened?
As we talked about last time, the Quartering Act of 1765, and then they'll do another one later, but the Quartering Act was to find places, because they moved all of these soldiers into the city. They had to have places for them to sleep, and they had to have resources for them to eat. So the British said, what we can do is just order them to be housed and fed by the colonists. Of course, that raised, like we said, the tensions even more there. I mean, how would you like to have a hated British soldier living and eating in your household? So Boston was the hottest
area. You know what? And Ben, we talk about freedom versus force versus freedom on the show all the time. This talk is talk about force making you cook and clean and all for somebody. I don't think Americans would like that very much these days either.
No, I don't think so. I think you're right. That was really force, and it was really not freedom. So Boston was the hottest spot of this colonial tension, and correspondingly, Gage then added to the fire by moving two British regiments there into the city of Boston, which further inflamed the city. And this led to the 1770 Boston Massacre. And later, as a result of the 1773 Tea Act, the Boston Tea Party came about on 16 December 1773. And the British then escalated the tensions and the stakes even further with the Coercive Acts of 1774, which the American colonists affectionately named the Intolerable Acts instead of the Coercive Acts. Tensions had now risen to a rolling boil in Boston. And in September of 1774, Gage moved the British soldiers stationed in New York City and in New Jersey, and in Philadelphia to Boston, and called in a large British naval force to reinforce his troops and block the harbor. He next ordered his forces to seize the colonists' store of gunpowder, as they had in Virginia, in an area just north of Boston, which is now called the city of Somerville. This caused the Sons of Liberty to mobilize thousands of militiamen and marched them towards Boston, an action which is now called the Powder Alarm. These militias soon dispersed, but that quick and massive military response sent a clear message to General Gage. As the situation evolved, growing more dire, Gage tried at times to mobilize his troops to take preemptive action against the Patriots, but they always seemed to know his planned action before he could execute them. Over the years, evidence has come to light. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I wanted to make the point here is I think because of this Gunpowder Act or this action on gunpowder is why right. we have the Second Amendment in our Constitution.
Oh, that's one of the reasons. You bet.
Because when you have a government that is trying to take away the right of people to protect themselves and to protect themselves against a tyrannical government, that is one of the things that really made the colonists very, very hot towards the British, Ben.
Oh, absolutely. And like they said, he kept trying to preemptively do things to stop these actions by what we call today the Sons of Liberty. But over the years, since that time, we have found evidence that has come to light that General Gage's wife, she was a beautiful lady, her name was Margaret Kimball Gage, may have assisted the American cause by providing this critical information to them about her husband's plans. And Margaret Gage was an American who harbored sympathies for the American patriots, and her secret contact was Dr. Joseph Warren, a key member of the Sons of Liberty in Boston, and a great American patriot.
I bet that made Thanksgiving interesting around there at their house. So, hey, I tell you what, Ben Martin, we're going to go to break. We'll be right back with patriotic historian, former Army Ranger, West Point grad, Ben Martin. Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I'm Kim Munson. Check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there, and you can email me at Kim@KimMunson.com as well. On the line with me is patriotic historian, former Army Ranger, West Point graduate, and that is Ben Martin. He has such a love for our history. I find this so fascinating. Just when we went to break, Ben, when you said that General Gage's wife was possibly giving information to the colonists about what the British were doing, it's just kind of the intrigue on all this is just astounding to me.
Yeah, I think you're right. But, you know, you can really appreciate her sympathies for the cause back then. And it came to light many times because General Gage was always scratching his head saying, you know, I only shared these orders with a couple of people. one of them being my second in command. He never said who the other one was, but we had reason to believe it was his wife, his beautiful and charming wife, Margaret Kimball Gage. Yeah. So General Gage was keeping the British government back in Britain informed of the rising tensions in Boston, Kim. And then on 14 April 1775, he received orders back from London to take decisive action against these riotous patriots. And so Gates, who had received intelligence that the militia had been stockpiling weapons at Concord, ordered a large detachment of British regulars from Boston garrison to march there to Concord on the night of 18 April to confiscate these arms and ammunition. The British, the Boston of Revolutionary Times, we need to kind of explain it geographically. It was very different from the Boston of today. So I worked up this little thing that I hope we can, the folks can envision through radio. Think of a large clock face as the Boston Bay. Then lay a spoon on the face of the clock with the tip of its handle at the 6 o'clock position on the clock face. The large part of the spoon will be roughly in the center of the clock face, and this would be Boston, this big area of the spoon in the middle of the Boston Bay. And the slim handle of the spoon that would go back to 6 o'clock time, that would be the Boston neck. It was very slim area there. And then the back bay would be the water surrounding the left side of the spoon from the 6 to 11 o'clock position on the clock face. And then the Charleston Peninsula, on which is located Bunker and Breed's Hill, extends into the back bay from the 11 o'clock position towards the big part of the spoon in the center of the clock face. And the clock face on the right side of the spoon is the main Boston Bay, which eventually leads into the ocean. And now with this idea of Boston, hopefully in our minds, let us talk about the battles of Lexington and Concord. Is that a kind of a clear picture?
It has helped, yes.
Well, now you know that whole area is all filled in with landfill, so there's no... There's no curve there anymore. You know, Boston Bay just sits right. Boston sits right there, surrounded by other land masses. But back then, it was just a little circle out there in the middle of the bay. So late in the evening of 18 April 1775, Gage, acting on the orders that came from London, had 700 British soldiers crossed the back bay of Boston in boats to begin the roughly 14-mile march to Lexington to capture the rebel leaders, John Hancock and Samuel Adams, and then continue another 6 miles on to Concord, there to secure the rebel arms and ammunition that was supposedly stashed there. All along their march, they were surprised to hear church bells ringing alarm. Hours earlier, though, Paul Revere had crossed the same waters, mounted a good horse, and galloped westward to spread the word to the patriots in Lexington and Concord and all those in between that the British regulars were out. William Dawes also was another one of these messengers. He was on horseback, and he crossed the Boston Neck along about the same time as Paul Revere, and he took the southern route to spread the same message to the patriots in the lands west of Boston. And the two riders made it to Lexington and were successful in warning the patriots all along the way. And those patriots who were so warned along the east-west route to Lexington and later Concord, they then sent their own riders north and south along these routes to further spread the alarm. When Revere and Dawes arrived in Lexington, they warned John Hancock and Samuel Adams that the Redcoats were on their way, and they intended to capture both of them. Hancock and Adams soon left to avoid capture. So as
Ben, I want
to. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, sure. I just want to jump in here because I really feel that the our constitutional republic is under assault today, and a couple of things. It's a little different, but our churches need to step forward. We have many churches that are still not meeting in person yet because of this whole COVID-19 China Wuhan virus reaction disruption. And we need to step forward with courage. Just think about that. As the British are moving forward, the church bells, the church is taking a stand to stand against tyranny. And I think that that's really important that we make this correlation. And then the other thing you said, that the patriots were out there basically informing people. These writers had informed people. And that's really what I think that is happening in conservative talk radio. And when we say the word conserve, Ben, a couple of things, and these are things that I think I really learned from you. First of all, I did a quote from George Washington about pride of country. And that had been under assault, having pride in America. And what you said to me was that it's not pride like puff your chest kind of pride. It's love of country. And then conserve, conservative means to conserve. And conservative here in America today means to conserve this idea that all men are created equal with these rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And so the voices that went out on what was that, 18 April 1775, to sound the alarm against tyranny and this assault on liberty, we have this same calls going out today, and we see that our culture is trying to cancel that and censor those voices. And I think that we are in a dangerous time today as well, Ben. Do you want to comment on that?
I certainly do, and I certainly agree with everything you say. This is a very dangerous time, and it takes real courage, just like it took courage here for these people to go out. And, you know, they weren't trained professional soldiers. They were just people that had their muskets at home that helped protect them and helped kill food so that they could eat. But they weren't trained soldiers. And for them to get together and resist the way they did and the coordination that they had made. And they used that the powder alarm that we talked about before, where they raised all of these militiamen and brought them to bear in Boston just to show the Brits there that they had the capability to do that. That helped. This was a practice for something like this that was a real alert that happened. So they had already gone through this before. They had already demonstrated to the British soldiers that they were willing to stand up for their independence and fight against this force that you're talking about, force versus freedom. And so, yes, this was a time. And so when Revere and Dawes made it to Lexington and warned the two big leaders of the Sons of Liberty there in the Boston, Massachusetts area, they did a great service, and they kept them from being captured. And when they were there, they met. They then left because they still had to go farther and warn the Patriots in Concord that the regulars, the Redcoats, were coming out of Boston, and they were there to take or capture their arms that they knew were stashed there in Concord. So they met another man, Dr. Samuel Prescott, who had a fiance that he had visited there in Lexington. But Dr. Prescott actually lived in Concord, and he was very familiar with the landscape around there, and he knew his way around that area. And so as they were riding, all three riders now, Revere, Dawes, and Prescott, were riding to Concord to warn the Patriots, a British soldiers had patrols out looking for people that shouldn't be out right then, and sort of like martial law, you know, a time for them to be inside. And so the British soldiers that were there that stopped them, kept them and were going to keep them so that they couldn't go farther and warn the people in the area of Concord. So while they were holding them there, the three men tried to escape, but Revere was captured before he could even make an attempt at escape. Dawes did escape the British patrol, but he was lost. He was misoriented. He did not know how to make it to Concord, and he did make it to Concord. Only Dr. Prescott knew well the area and was able to successfully escape the Brits, and he was the only one of the three to make it to Concord to warn the Patriots there. And to go back to the British soldiers who crossed the Back Bay in boats, they finally arrived on the west side of the Back Bay into Cambridge. And they were not well organized. They were pretty confused about what they were doing, and it took them a long time to get organized before they could start moving. And so they didn't start moving towards Lexington and Concord until about 2 o'clock in the morning. And they had haversacks, heavy muskets, ammunition, and they marched through the darkness and reached Lexington a little before sunrise. And there on the village green were 80 militiamen, and their leader, Captain Parker, had been a soldier in the French and Indian War. He was over 70 years old, and he was suffering from tuberculosis. And the militia commander there, Captain Parker, told his men, when he saw this big force of British regulars come into the village green, he said, "Stand your ground. Don't fire unless fired upon. But if they mean to have a war," he said, "let it begin here." And the leader of the advanced detachment of British soldiers, which was approximately 200, was Major Pitcairn, who was a Marine, a British Marine, who told the militiamen, "Lay down your weapons, you damned rebels." And then, with both sides facing each other, a shot rang out, and no one knows from which side it came. And in response, both sides fired volleys at their opposing force. And the result of that were eight American militiamen died, and another like number were wounded. The British had only one soldier wounded from that engagement. And then, after a reasonable delay of them standing there looking at each other and then the American militiamen dispersing, the British continued their march toward Concord, which was approximately another 6 miles.
Well, let's go to break. Sure. Let's go to break, Ben Martin, and when we come back, we'll continue to talk about these important battles of the Revolutionary War. This show is brought to you by the Harris family. I'm talking with patriotic historian Ben Martin. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I'm Kim Munson. Check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there, and you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. This is just an amazing show. It's brought to you by the Harris family, patriotic historian, former Army Ranger, West Point grad, Ben Martin. We're talking about the battles of the American Revolutionary War. I can't believe we're in the last segment. So, Ben, I'm just going to let you take it from here.
Okay, well, I'll kind of run through this pretty quickly, but it's very important, Kim. So when the British soldiers left Lexington, they marched the 6 miles, and then they arrived in Concord approximately 9 o'clock in the morning, maybe a little bit earlier. Lieutenant Colonel Smith, who was their commander of that force, then organized their force into five separate parties and sent them to different locations throughout Concord to execute General Gage's orders. One party secured the South Bridge and searched for the nearby area for weapons and ammunition. Another party secured the North Bridge. A larger party crossed the North Bridge and went further into the farm that was owned by Colonel Bartlett, the leader of the militia there in Concord, to search for weapons and ammunition. And an additional party trailed them as their route north and secured the road to ensure that they could safely return after searching Bartlett's farm. And another party went into the center of town, again, to search for weapons and ammunition. The Patriots, who had been warned, had hidden or moved most of the arsenal that they had stored in and around Concord. However, the British did find three massive cannons buried near the South Bridge. They smashed the trunnions of the cannons and burned the wooden carriages of the cannons. However, the British did not discover the 550 pounds of musket balls hidden in the mill pond, nor the muskets that were buried in the fields at Bartlett's farm. Meanwhile, the militia force from the town surrounding Concord began to arrive and assemble in the hills north of Colonel Barrett's farm, and they planned their attack on the British forces from there. The first target was to attack the British holding the North Bridge. And as the militia moved toward the North Bridge, the British forces that were securing the road for the safe return of those British soldiers that were still in the north part of Bartlett's farm, they withdrew, leaving the route unguarded and the soldiers unsecured. So the militia then approached the bridge. Then they formed into two columns to cross the bridge. The British guarding the bridge withdrew to the north side of the bridge, and then regrouped on the south side where they were going to defend the bridge. The militia that had volunteered to lead the attack across the North Bridge were from the town of Acton, and that's pretty important, the militia there. And their commander was Captain Isaac Hayes, who was also a gunsmith, and he made bayonets for his men so that they were confident in attacking the British, and they were the only militia company that was so equipped with bayonets. He led his company across the North Bridge from the front of one of the two columns that had been formed. When the crossing forces began exchanging fires, the brave Captain Isaac Davis was the first American officer to be killed in the Revolutionary War. His likeness can be seen on the Minuteman statue near the bridge in Concord today. And the British guarding that bridge eventually withdrew into the main part of Concord and then reorganized, ate rations, and prepared for the 20-mile march back. And during that time, between the early morning alarm by Revere, Dawes, and then later Prescott, and the time spent from the British forces in marching and fighting the battles of Lexington and Concord, many militiamen from the surrounding towns had begun to assemble along the routes back to Boston. And as the fatigued British forces struggled to make their way back to the safety of their home base, the many militiamen who had answered their early call to arms, again, talking about the courage that they had, attacked the British from both sides of the road and inflicted many casualties on their long march home. And as they were getting back to Boston, that was 6 miles, they were totally exhausted. They had been up for the day before and all through the night in that morning, and they were almost out of ammunition. Some had already surrendered to the militia, and assuredly the whole force would soon have to surrender because they soon would have no ammunition with which to fight. Luckily, Lieutenant Colonel Smith had sent a messenger back to General Gage in Boston early that morning as he was first approaching Lexington, and he heard all these church bells ring. So the message he sent back was requesting more reinforcements because he knew he had lost the element of surprise and would probably face overwhelming militia forces on his return march back to Boston. That answer for reinforcement came in the form of a reinforced brigade of approximately 1,000 well-rested and well-armed troops under the able command of Lord General Percy. And once Smith's troops made their way back to Lexington, General Percy took command of the combined force, which was now about 1,700 people, 1,700 soldiers, and organized them and made them ready for the long march back to Boston. General Percy put Smith's troops in the middle of his protected formation, and they began their fight back to their home base at approximately 3:30 in the afternoon. Percy made some wise decisions in his efforts to get his men back to safety, but his force still suffered many casualties in the process. And had General Percy and his relief force not arrived in time to heroically do this for the stranded British forces, the outcome for the British could have been a complete loss of Smith's men. It was nearly dark when Major Pitcairn's Marines defended a final attack on Percy's rear as he entered the town of Charleston on that peninsula that we talked about. Mm-hmm. Pitcairn's men, and this is pretty ironic, established strong defensive positions on the hills of Charleston, And as Percy's force reentered the vicinity of Boston, General Gage sent out additional troops for reinforcement and to protect them as they got back into the city. These troops occupied the high grounds in Charleston, Kim, and they started building defensive positions there. And although these positions were never completed by the British troops, they ironically became the starting points for the strong defensive positions the American militia would build there 2 months later in June before the battle now known as Bunker Hill. And the aftermath of the battle, in talking about that aftermath, it can be said that the British soldiers' losses were comparatively significant and shocking to Gage's troops in Boston and the British politicians and public back in London. The British casualties numbered 73 killed, 174 wounded, and 26 missing. The American casualties, by comparison, were only 49 killed, 41 wounded, and 5 missing. The American Revolutionary War of the War for Independence had now begun. The battles of Lexington and Concord were not as important for the British casualties they produced, but they plainly illustrated to the British and to the world the willingness of the American patriots to fight for their independence and the failure of the British policies that had established and imposed things like the Intolerable Acts. In the days immediately following the battles, approximately 15,000 militiamen had assembled around the city, and organized by the American generals there, they began the siege of Boston. The size of the American forces there would continue to grow as militia from New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Connecticut arrived. The British responded by sending another 4,500 troops to Boston. Now the troops in Boston numbered almost 10,000, and they arrived there on 25 May 1775, along with three ambitious generals named William Howe, Henry Clinton, and John Burgoyne. And we'll hear more about those as we talk more about the Revolutionary War. The Continental Congress responded in June by claiming that large force of militiamen surrounding Boston as their Continental Army. And on 16 June 1775, George Washington accepted their unanimous nomination as the commander-in-chief. And then he arrived in Boston on 3 July 1775, which was a little bit after the 17 June Battle of Bunker Hill. And approximately 100 yards from that famous Old North Bridge where we talked about the fighting, where Captain Isaac Hayes had died, there's a house called the Old Manse, and it was standing there during that fight. And it was owned by Reverend William Emerson, who was the pastor of the village of Concord, but he also became a pastor in the Revolutionary War.
And on that, we're out of time now, Ben Martin, and we've got to hear this next story, so we'll go to this next month when we do this show again, and I think what we'll end up maybe doing is expanding this out into next year as well. So, Ben Martin, thank you so much. It's great to have you on. I've just been on the edge of my seat with all these stories. Thank you so much.
Well, it's been great sharing them with you, Kim, and it's always fun being with you. So thank you so much for your time and for the Harris family.